27, I had a little farm and I called it heaven. Prices up and rain come down and I hauled my crops all into town. I got the money, bought clothes and groceries, fed the kids, took it easy. The rain it quit and the wind got high and the black old dust storms filled the sky. And I swapped my farm for a Ford machine and I filled it full of this gas I lean and started. California. Way up yonder on a mountain road, I had a hot motor and a heavy load. I was going pretty fast, I wasn't even stopping. I was bouncing up and down like popcorn a popping, had a breakdown. Sort of a nervous bust down of the mechanism there, some kind of engine trouble. Here's the way up yonder on the mountain road. I wasn't feeling so very good, and I give this rolling Ford a shove, and I was gonna coast as far as I could. Commenced rolling, picking up speed, and there was a hairpin turn, and I couldn't make it. Man alive, I'm telling you, the fiddles and the guitars really flew. That Ford took off like a flying squirrel, and it flew halfway around the world. Scattered wives and childrens all over the side of that mountain. We got to old Los Angeles broke, so that gum hungry we thought we'd choke. And I bummed up a spud or two, and my wife cooked up a tater stew. Fed the kids a big bait of it, but that was mighty thin stew. And that gum thin, you could pretty near read a magazine through it. If it's been just a little bit thinner, I've always believed that stew had been just a little bit thinner, some of our senators could have seen through it.
The real great adventures of me, Tom Terrific, with Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog.
Ever. Terrific is the name for me, cause I'm so clever. I can be what I wanna be, and if you'd like to see, follow, follow me. If you see a plane on high, a diesel train go roaring by, a bumblebee or a tree, it's me. When there is trouble, I'm there on the double, from Atlantic to Pacific. They know I'm terrific.
I'm Mighty Manfred, the Wonder Dog, and Tom Dever, faithful companion.
And today is the second day of October. Now, you got plenty of time to get it done, that special thing you want to do. You got plenty of time in this month, so get at it, man. Get at it. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And I want to remind you, when you send your donations in for the show, make sure that the email address is either on the inside of the envelope or the outside of the envelope or someplace, so I don't miss it, because that's the way I keep track of things around here. I don't keep your names and addresses around here. And every once in a while I'm getting donations in with no email address, and that confuses the hell out of me. If you're in a zip code 48661 in the state north of Indiana, I'm going to code this stuff, and your first initial is C. You sent me your donation, but you didn't send an email address. And what I try to do when I get the donations in, is send, and I give you credit, keep track of it, then I send you out a note that I got it. Now, if you don't get a note that I've got it within a week or so after you send it, get back with me, because there may be a problem. Also, I don't download the PayPal stuff every day, maybe once a week, and so we might be a little late on the PayPal recognition. But when I do it, I send you also a note that I've got your donation. So, and like I say, then if you go for a week, maybe 2 weeks, and you get no radio show, somehow you get cut off, well, contact me and we'll get it straightened out. And I appreciate you guys that catch when we only half a show goes out due to technical things beyond our control. I try to take time to listen to the show after I do it, but I don't always get that done. So, day before yesterday, or yesterday I guess it was, when somebody advised me we only had 20 minutes of the show. I have no idea why that happens. I've had it happen before. The show is definitely totally recorded onto MP3. We know that, but something seems to happen in the uploading. Now, with this new, we're on DirecTV now instead of, forget what we were on Infinity, and it's a lot slower upload. I can get a faster upload. I don't know. I have to check on how much it costs. But it doesn't make much difference if it gets up there, because I've got time to wait here for a couple of minutes for an upload. That's no big problem. But we're going to try to run down this reason why this thing once in a while only sends out half a show. So that's our problem here. We'll get all our engineers and technicians on it, man. We may have to fly them in from California or New York City. New York City? Okay. Thanks, my Las Vegas lone wolf, for the stamps, too. Sometimes people send us stamps, and if you want to send us a bunch of stamps in lieu of cash, that's fine, too. But don't send me too many, because I can't use a tremendous amount. But we do use quite a few stamps. There's two things that really stick in my craw, which it should stick in everybody's craw, I'm sure, and that's we're an equal opportunity employer. Well, that's impossible. That's impossible, because people are not equal. People don't have equal skills. Some people are smarter than others. Other people have more experience. Some people are sickly and going to be taken off work every once in a while like that. So when they say an equal opportunity employer, well, you can take it that they're saying, well, we're going to use the same standards to hire you, but still, again, you're unequal. So how can they use the same standards? Why don't they just say whoever's the best gets the job? But that really sticks in my craw, and you should remind people of that when you talk to them. There is no such thing as equal opportunity. And the other thing is, these people and the neocons, of course, all these conservatives that are on the radio now are neocons. I don't give a shit what they say. They're neocons. They're nothing like the conservatives that were around when I started out. Conservatives I knew when I started out, none of them would have voted for the equal wrongs bill. They wouldn't have voted for any of this crazy stuff like Republicans do now. And I hear them all the time, Republicans trying to catch up with the demo crazies by saying like this, well, anybody that judges people by their skin got to be a moron. Well, it's not just the skin. The skin is just an observable symbol given to people by nature. And as simple as that. And just because a person has a dark skin doesn't necessarily mean they're idiots, and sometimes they're very smart. But it means they're not of your family, your racial family. So So when they come walking down the street and you see a person black as the ace of spades, you don't have to sit there and think about it. You know nature has symbolically stamped him or her that they're not of your people. They're not of your evolutionary track. And so, but they love to say that. You're just judging people because of their skin. In other words, if I went out there and got real suntan, you know, a white man can get sunburned as hell to look like a mulatto or something. Well, does that mean people would just judge me by my skin? No, that's a bullshit argument, and all these conservative neocons are doing it. I just had to go into the VA this morning to show you how dumb the government is. I get a notice to come into the VA, and I figure it's another just routine blood test or something like that. And I get there, and it's a psychiatrist or psychologist. He says, and I never seen the guy before, and he says, do you know why you're here? I said, hell no. Do you know? He said, no, I don't know either. I said, well, why in the hell did they tell me to come up here if nobody knows what the hell's going on? He said, I don't know. I guess they got you mixed up on the list or something. So I drove round trip about 50 miles for some yo-yo to tell me, well, no, I didn't request you come in here. But while I was there, he said, do you feel okay? Do you feel depressed? Only when I watched the news. We both had a big laugh out of that. It seemed like a nice guy, but this is how incompetent probably lower-level workers are in the VA. I've had that happen before once, where if you go in the morning, it turns out it's a fast. You don't eat all night. But if you go in the afternoon, you can eat all night. Well, they didn't tell me that. I go ramming up there. I ate in a whole bit. So I get up there and some dummy says, did you eat? And I said, hell yes, I ate. Well, if you have a morning appointment, it's a fasting deal. I said, nobody ever told me that. Do you tell people that? Well, I don't know. I guess they're supposed to know. So, you know, you got a lot of low-level incompetence in these places. Oh, yeah, that was Comcast that we had before. It was a lot faster, but I think I was in another program. Not slow downloading. It downloads fine. It's fast downloading, but it's just uploading a little slow. Now, as you know, I'm a strong advocate of right to keep and bear arms, that's for sure. But they've got this situation where people can carry guns into the stores, and not only a concealed handgun, which I don't really have too much problem with someone's got a concealed weapon carry permit, but some of these yahoos from the right wing are carrying in rifles into the damn grocery stores. Now, I'll tell you what, I know enough about these right wing types to know that I don't trust them around me with a gun. I don't. They tend to be a lot of them gun happy. So anyhow, now Kroger Stores Corporation, just one of the corporations. Now there's a lot of things they don't allow you to do in their store. I mean, probably you couldn't wear a bikini in there or something like that. But they're allowing people to carry loaded guns into their stores. Now the right wing saying, oh, this is wonderful, boy, this is wonderful, got a right to keep and bear arms. Well, let me tell you something. I hate to sound like a progressive, even though sometimes the progressives are right. They're right in this case. I don't want some guy walking around me with a damn AK-47, legal or illegal, in a grocery store. Because I know how people can get over a little, oh, you bumped my card, bam, 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 you know. Oh, you grabbed that, I wanted that, yeah, bam, 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 bam. A lot of people get drunk and go shopping. And a guy being drunk or a woman being drunk carrying a damn gun in a grocery store, get me a break. I think that we have to be reasonable about things. I've never seen anything happen in a grocery store that I couldn't handle with the pepper spray. And people who are going to carry especially a rifle, I've got some pictures here I'll send to you, are people who are braggadocious kind of people, mostly guys with small penises. I agree with the left on that. These guys like to have guns everywhere, guns all around, guns in my car, guns in my pants, guns under my arm, a little bit everywhere. I do believe that it has it's a penis thing. So I don't know what you think about it, but anyway, I'll send these pictures of these yahoos walking down the aisles of a grocery store, Kroger Grocery. We got one here in town, and I'm going to tell them when I go in there, I ain't coming in there unless nobody with guns. You know, most people wouldn't use a gun anyhow. That's the other side of people, and when they would need to be using a gun, they're too chicken shit to pull the trigger. I mean, I've seen there's a lot of guys have been killed that way, that they were confronted. They had a gun, but didn't have the balls to pull the trigger. In fact, they've proven in battle that only about 20 to 30% of the time do soldiers shoot to kill, which in a way is a good thing because, you know, the average guy really doesn't want to kill somebody. They're sociopaths out there and psychopaths, yeah, but the average guy, when he's face to face with an enemy, don't want to kill him. And sometimes that hesitation gets him killed, but that's the way it goes there. I think this whole thing about carrying guns in the store are going to hurt gun right to keep and bear arms people. That's going to do more to give them bad publicity. If I didn't know better, I'd think that the anti-gun people got that stuff going. Well, the Jews, just like the Christian crooks, hypocrites, in this story, why gangsters who broke every law still went to services on Yom Kippur, which is supposed to be one of the high holy days of the Jews. On Yom Kippur in 1929, Louis Fleischman, Harry Flesher, and Henry Shore attended services at Orthodox Congregation B'nai David in northwest Detroit. The three men, all sterling members of the Purple Gang, Detroit's mostly Jewish mob, had plenty to atone for. The Purple Gang controlled the city's illegal gambling, smuggled liquor during the Prohibition, and had a hand in most of Detroit's underworld vice. The gang didn't hesitate to resort to violence, arson, bombings, and murder. When its operations were threatened, they were reputedly more ruthless than the Chicago Capone Gang. The three gangsters didn't notice three men sitting in the back of the synagogue, G-men described as disguised in black Hasidic garb, who hoped to arrest the three hoodlums after the service. But when the non-Jewish G-men lit up cigarettes during the intermission, not knowing that striking a match or lighting a fire is forbidden on Yom Kippur, their cover was blown and the gangsters got away. The men of the Purple Gang weren't the only Jewish mobsters who observed Jewish rituals, even as they committed crimes that broke all the Ten Commandments, as I discovered while doing research for my book on Jewish mobsters. But he was good to his mother, The Lives and Crimes of Jewish Gangsters. That might be an interesting book to get. When examining FBI files and interviewing old-time Jewish criminals and their relatives, I found that plenty of Jewish mobsters prayed in the synagogue on Shabbat, observed Jewish holidays, maintained religious rituals, fasted on Yom Kippur, and attended Passover Seders, just like their equally hypocritical Christian brothers. Sam Red Levine provides a singular illustration of this. Levine was the New York City gangster Charlie Lucky Luciano's favorite contract killer, according to Martin Gosch and Richard Hammer's 1975 book, The Last Testament of Lucky Luciano. Lucky called Red the best driver and hitman I had. Red also had another persona. He was an Orthodox Jew. He always wore a kippah under his hat. ate only kosher food, and conscientiously observed the Sabbath. Levine never planned to murder anyone from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. But according to Gosch and Hammer, if Levine had no chance and had to make a hit on the Shabbat, he would first put on a tallit, a piece of clothes that observant Jews wear, say his prayers, and then go out and do the job. Abner Longy Zwillman, dubbed the Al Capone of New Jersey, reigned as king of the rackets in Newark from the Prohibition era until 1950s. Next to Meyer Lansky, he was the most prominent Jewish mob boss in America. He reached his pinnacle through the brains and violence. Despite his reputation as a ruthless mobster, Zwillman maintained sensitive to his Jewish upbringing. Jerry Kugel, whose father, Jaime, was Longy's good friend, told me the following story when I interviewed him in 1991. When Jaime died, Zwillman stood outside and would not enter the chapel where the casket lay. Jerry could not understand this slight. He asked Zwillman why he wouldn't go into the funeral parlor. Zwillman replied that he couldn't. "Why?" asked Jerry. "Because I'm a Kohen," said Zwillman. As a descendant of the priestly class, he was forbidden to come into contact with a dead body. There are other examples from all around the country of Jewish gangsters obeying certain Jewish laws. How does one explain hoodlums, killers, vicious and violent men adhering to certain biblical injunctions? Well, look at the Godfather, the Italians. What about the Sixth Commandment, thou shalt not murder, and the Eighth Commandment, thou shalt not steal? Why this paradox in their lives? The Purples and the most Jewish gangsters during Prohibition were the children of Eastern European Jewish immigrants who had come to the United States between 1881 and 1914. The mobsters had been born in America or come as kids, according to Arthur Hertzberg in his 1997 book, The Jews in America. Most of their parents had not been part of the religious elite of their communities. The more pious and religiously orthodox Jews heeded their rabbis' warnings that America was a trefe medina, non-kosher land, and stayed behind in Europe. Nonetheless, the Jews who did immigrate came from places where the Jewish religion and Jewish traditions persisted as an integral part of the milieu. Most of the immigrants may not have been orthodox according to Jewish law, but they maintained traditional Jewish religious patterns and brought these practices with them to America. Out of habit, a non-believing Jew might still observe the dietary laws at home, occasionally go to synagogue, and say Kaddish for departed parents. These immigrants practice what sociologist Charles Liebman, in his 1993 book, The Ambivalent American Jew, called a kind of Jewish folk religion. The Jewish mobsters grew up in these traditional homes in Jewish neighborhoods that were infused with folk Judaism, such as New York's Lower East Side, Chicago's West Side, and Detroit's East Side. And like many of their non-criminal peers, some of them continued these behavioral patterns into adulthood. Jewish ritual remained an indelible part of their identity, a part of who and what they were. Perhaps the greatest influence on the Jewishness of these men were their mothers. Many of the major Jewish mobsters, including Meyer Lansky, Dutch Schultz, Lepke Buchalter, Longy Zwillman, and Mickey Cohen, as well as those I interviewed, revered their mothers. Family and friends recounted to me how these men doted on their mothers and treated them with the utmost kindness and respect. In 1979, the book Meyer Lansky, Mogul of the Mob, Lansky told Israeli journalist Yuri Dan how his mother hated to see us go hungry, and she was always ready to give us her share because, like every Jewish mother in the neighborhood, she gladly sacrificed herself for her children, unquote. These men's relationship with their fathers was more problematic. Part of this resulted from the fathers never reconciling to their sons' criminal way of life. Jewish mothers sacrificed for their children, but they expected something in return. One of their requests was that their sons say Yidden, be Jews, and maintain a connection with the Jewish community. at least during their mother's lifetime. A goodly number of these tough Jewish mobsters obeyed. Detroit mobster Harry Kasser told me in 1986 conversation that he attended synagogue on the High Holy Days solely to please his mother. All of the old-time Jewish mobsters I interviewed could speak Yiddish and practice some of the Jewish customs. Some of their closet friends and associates in crime and outside of crime were Jews. They married Jewish women, at least their first wives, in ceremonies conducted by rabbis. They contributed to Jewish causes. They attended synagogue on the high holidays, and they circumcised their sons and made bar mitzvahs. Another factor to the paradox of these men's lives was their ability to separate what they did to earn a living, their business lives, and the way they behaved in their personal lives. Behaviorists refer to this as compartmentalization, being able to act one way in private world and another way in the public sphere, even if the result was blatantly inconsistent behavior. Well, simply hypocrites. This paradox was expressed to me by a lawbreaker named Myron. He asked me not to use his family name. For years, the FBI tried and failed to obtain a conviction against him. The Internal Revenue succeeded, however, and Myron ended up going to prison for income tax evasion. When we spoke in 1991, I asked him if he wanted his son to follow in his footsteps with all the dangers it entailed. He replied, quote, "I would say to him that I chose my life, you go choose your life. The only thing is that whatever you choose to do, I would say to him you got to put on a Teflon every morning. You got to eat kosher meat, and you have to maintain certain principles." Throughout their lives, Jewish mobsters remained products of their home and the environments in which they grew up, whether they believed in God or not. In adulthood, they continued the Jewish traditions they learned as children, no matter how vile their later behavior. In each of these men, there remained a pintel, yid, a spark of Jewishness. Meyer Lansky, the alleged godfather of Jewish organized crime, told me in 1980 that he was a non-believer. Yet he maintained his membership in a synagogue, regularly contributed money for its upkeep, and attended services on Jewish holidays. Labor racketeer Lepke Buchwalder displayed similar paradoxical behavior. He commanded an army of gangsters who terrorized New York's garment industry. His gang's weapons were destructive acids, bludgeons, blackjacks, knives, fire, ice picks, and guns. At his peak, he controlled a wide assortment of business and unions, including the bakery and pastry drivers, the milliners, the garment workers, the poultry market, the taxicab business, the motion picture operators, and the fur truckers. Despite the murderous brutality he exercised in his business affairs, he was a considerate son and a doting husband and father. He described himself as a Jew, contributing money to his mother's synagogue, attending high holy services, and according to the FBI, led a quiet home life. The paradox sometimes lasted till the end of the mobster's life. Harry Gyp the Blood Horowitz was a vicious brute and killer of enormous strength who thought nothing of breaking a man's back for fun. In 1914, he and his accomplices were convicted of murdering gambler Herman Rosenthal and were sentenced to death, according to the April 18, 1914 edition of the Forward. After being strapped into the electric chair at Sing Sing, Gyp recited the Shema. When he finished, a jolt of electricity surged through his body, killing him instantly. One of his accomplices, Louis Lefty Louis Rosenberg, died in the electric chair holding a chamash. These are all Jewish paraphernalia that the Orthodox use. Later in life, many of the Jewish mobsters strayed far from the traditions of their youth, but almost all of them received Jewish burials at their death. Despite the brutal and illegal nature of their lives they led, at their demise, many of these underworld figures still remain tied to their families, their people, and Jewish traditions. Well, there you go. There you go. This, I believe, was written by Robert Rockaway, professor emeritus at Tel Aviv University, the author of But He Was Good to His Mother, The Lives and Crimes of Jewish Gangsters. So, you say the Jews never talk about themselves? They never give up any secrets or anything? That's bullshit. They tell a lot. They love to talk about themselves. In fact, they probably talk straighter, no matter whether you like it or not, than most Christians. Another little insight you want to think about. Last week, this author traveled to the United States for the publication of his book, The War on Women in Israel, a story of religious radicalism and the women fighting for freedom in Israel. Oh, I thought everybody was wonderfully free in Israel. You're kidding me. It was a whirlwind week. I traveled to events and book signings across 5 cities and 4 states in 10 days. I signed a lot of books, met some fabulous people, and heard from many people, men and women, who were deeply gratified, grateful for the moderate voice calling for an end to the religious extremism that's hurting women. That's why what happened to me on the flight home to Israel was so shocking and so upsetting. The plane took off 20 minutes late because of an ultra-Orthodox man was negotiating with passengers so as not to have to sit next to a woman, me, on the 11th-hour flight. I asked myself if this was karma or poetic justice. After all, I had just spoken to hundreds of people about exactly these issues and the way women are made to feel like second-class citizens as a result of exactly these issues. Part of me wanted to smile and hand out copies of my book, but I sat there silently for a long time watching all this happen, witnessing all these men around me talking about me, mostly in Yiddish, but also in Hebrew and English, without looking directly at me. I sat there torn between my desire not to make a scene and my feeling that if I don't articulate right here and now, how all this affects women. How this affects me, who will? So finally I spoke out. Right before the man found a replacement to sit next to me, I said, "Can I say something?" And without looking at me, I said, "Imagine if instead men and women were talking about Jews and non-Jews. Imagine how you would feel if a bunch of non-Jews were standing around saying that they can't sit next to you because you're a Jew, that they are willing to sit anywhere but next to you because their religion won't allow it, because you are impure or different or whatever. How would you feel? How would you get to ever get over that insult?" I could feel my voice ringing. I could feel my voice rising after all these years of writing about this, after this whole tour where I went around listening to people and sharing ideas. I just couldn't stay silent in the face of this humiliation. I'm not sure whether it mattered. One young man very kindly said to me, "You don't understand. Women are holier than men," unquote. I said, quote, "That's rubbish, and it doesn't excuse the insult." And then I added that I spent 13 years in yeshiva, and there's nothing he could tell me that I haven't heard already. Then the original man, the one who refused to sit next to me, muttered to another man as he was walking away, quote, "She doesn't understand." I said, "I understand everything, and don't talk to me as if I'm not here." He ignored me, and all the other men turned their backs and did not respond or even look at me. This is a long article. I'm going to knock it off there. But you see, these people are such hypocrites. Israel is very, very racist in their way. And they're like the Christians, women second-class citizens. I mean, as well as I do that all come out of religion, whether it was the Christian religion that got it out of Judaism or Islam or any of that stuff. It's all because of religion and the people who wrote the books on religion and the Bible. They've used it against women forever. Now, that doesn't make me a super pro, what would you call it? I'm not a male chauvinist, but I'm not the other way either. White men and white women, especially Aryans, are a team. If they're not a team, they're nothing. The men have certain roles that they practice that they're more equipped to do, and women have roles that they're more equipped to do. Once in a while, it crosses over. I mean, I've seen gals that could lift a railroad tie And I've seen guys that couldn't lift a fork, you know. So it goes along that way. But the point is the hypocrisy of the Israelis, the Jews in Israel, or wherever they're at. They're always first to shake their finger at Aryans or neo-Nazis or anybody like that. But in fact, they're worse. I mean, they say they love the niggers, but the blacks live like hell. They have a hell of a time in Israel. They're at the bottom of the barrel again. And all those blacks that took them at their word and came up from south of Sudan and all those places, they're building the world's largest prison to keep them in. So, but that's the problem with the world and the United States or any place else. It's hypocrisy. The blatant hypocrisy of everybody. I mean, if you're not a hypocrite, you're a rare person. Incidentally, JNR, I sent you your request, and I'm sad to say that after this, we're out of that particular material, and when you see my little scratchy note, you'll know why. Wait a minute. Well, a high-achieving Arab woman has been the cause of media frenzy over the last few days, though mostly for the wrong reasons. Major Miriam al-Mansouri, the UAE's first female fighter pilot, led the joint airstrikes on ISIL targets in Syria by the U.S. and its five Arab allies last week. Her contribution to the war effort was widely publicized and admired. You notice that? Bombing people, killing people, women and children, unintended circumstances, but maybe intended. But it quickly took a wrong turn when two male presenters on the Fox News made sexist jokes about Mansouri. You see, no one's interested in how do you feel about killing all these people on the ground? Nobody asked her that. They're asking her about sexist things. In the now notorious segment, an initial report by Kimberly Guilfoyle paid tribute to Mansouri's achievement. Quote, I wish that I were an American pilot. I'll take a woman for doing this any day to them, she said. Though it was unclear whether she was more impressed by Mansouri's professional achievement or the humiliation she assumed would be inflicted on the ISIL fighters, male fighters, because of the pilot's gender. Quote, I hope that hurt extra bad, she said, because in some Arab countries women can't even drive, unquote. To the driving, I will return. Guilfoyle's report had barely ended when Greg Gutfeld, another Jew, problem is after she bombed it, she couldn't park it, unquote, provoking groans in the studio. Eric Bowling upped the ante with, quote, would that be considered boobs on the ground or no, unquote. The sexist jokes instantly undermined the entire interview and its celebration of Mansouri's achievement. It also has punctured the female journalist's achievement, as Guilfoyle clearly felt when she repeatedly complained, oh my God, why do you have to ruin my thing? Well, my point is that so you got a woman fighter, so she can go up and strafe and bomb and kill civilians like all the men do. No one asks her questions like that. No one suggests that she's become part of the war killer machine. Yeah, the only problem they have is about sexist jokes. What do you think is going to happen if she gets shot down and captured and becomes a prisoner? Yes. You hardly ever hear any criticism of fighter pilots who bomb and strafe civilian targets. Oh, well, we never do that. Well, that's bullshit. Bomber pilots from World War II that still brag, and I hear them bragging, the ones that are still alive, about dropping tens of thousands of tons of bombs on working class neighborhoods in Germany, and I'm sure the Luftwaffe guys brag about bombing England and all that kind of stuff. The public tends to be warmongerish and have high regard for these people, as far as I'm concerned. Since the United States was not attacked by any European nation in World War II, then it was war crimes even back then, as far as I'm concerned. I know I was sitting in Lawrence Welk's Country Club out in California once, and I've told you this before, but maybe you don't remember. And I heard two World War II veterans laughing and bragging about dropping all these bombs on Germany, and I came within a hair's bit of walking over and smashing them both in the mouth. Well, a short note from one of our supporters. How's life in Warsaw? Gotta be better than this hellhole. Ebola is here officially in Texas, like it probably has been cases around for years that they've been lying about. Business as usual. Anyway, I thought I'd shoot a message to you. Take care. Well, this thing down there, you know, I was talking about Ebola at least 5 years ago, might have been 10, when it started showing up there in Africa and how horrible it was and how dangerous it was. So we've had plenty of warning. It wasn't a big secret about how horrible you die if you get Ebola. And when I tell you, you thumb your nose at Mother Nature, and Mother Nature is going to kick your ass. And that's what's happening now. You see, all the political bullshit about equality and don't offend anybody causes things like this to happen, where this nigger came here. I guess he brought his family here or screwed some white woman that had half-breed kids there in Texas. And then he goes back to Africa, Liberia, or Nigeria, I forget which. And there were witnesses to the fact that he carried an Ebola-infected woman from out of her house to take her someplace, or take her from someplace to her house. So he had her in his arms. And that information was available. Then he gets on a plane and comes over here and goes to the hospital, and instead of slapping him in isolation, instead of doing that, they say, oh, well, take some of these antibiotics and a couple of aspirins and go home. To where he infected or put people at risk over 100 people. Well, all I could say is I hope the 100 people were of his race. Now, they never learn. This Center for Disease Control is puffed up to be a lot more efficient than it is. However, they did say the other day that if it keeps going like this, by the first of the year, by next year, there could be 1 million or so Ebola. Well, you know, much of this stuff comes from these wars in these countries. Look at after World War I, the great epidemic in Europe. And before that, with the Hundred Years' War and the 40 Years' War, and after that, the plague came. Well, all over Africa, they're fighting and arming and dictators, and everybody's shooting at each other. Now Ebola's, instead of being a small, localized problem at one time, now has exploded. I submit it's all about this warmongering and war action in these countries, whether it be in white countries or non-white countries. And it's the punishment for warfare, when health standards go down and dead bodies laying all around, all that kind of stuff. So Mother Nature may help us out of this mess. We may go down with it, but she may help us out. I think if we look at it the right way, we may come out on top. Supposedly, the Cubans sent over 6,000 or 8,000 doctors or medical operatives and nurses. Now they're going to drag it back to Cuba. And then more Cubans will be fleeing for their lives out of Cuba to get into the United States and drag it into Miami and so forth. Oh boy, it's going to be interesting. Well, from the religion news, we have this. from the Department of Give Us This Day Our Daily Jackpot. What are Americans praying for? Well, besides themselves, a favorite sports team, go Nats, a winning lottery ticket, a good parking space, and curiously, the end to someone else's relationship. From the Department of You Just Can't Make This Stuff Up, Brian Pellet serves up an epic religious freedom recap, including this choice line, quote, in more statue porn news, a Pennsylvania teen faces 2 years in prison on charges of desecrating a venerated object. He got frisky with a Jesus statue. From the Department of What's a Freaking Mess, New York Times has all the gory details about the complete meltdown between the faculty, the president, and the board of the Episcopal Church's flagship seminary in Manhattan. Episcopal presiding bishop Catherine Jeffords Shorey sat in one chapel services yesterday. The AP reports, meanwhile, Mark Silk offers a tongue-in-cheek rebuttal to the belly-aching faculty. From the Department of Spare the Rod, no one really spares the rod. Americans say they're cool with spanking misbehaving children, but are not cool with using instruments, whips, belts, switches, as part of the corporal punishment, according to a new poll. Well, I'm going to tell you something. Some people can hit you harder with a hand than you can with a switch. I know it happened when I was a kid. From the Department of Not the Kind of Guy You'd Want to Share a Beer With, Gregory Holt will get a chance to air his grievances at the Supreme Court next week over prison's officials' refusal to let him grow a beard in accordance with his Muslim religious beliefs. Looks like he's got pretty much everyone outside of Arkansas on his side. From the Department of Not So Happily Ever After, remember the Oregon bakery that refused to bake a wedding cake for a lesbian couple? The owners say the $150,000 fine will likely lead them to bankruptcy. Isn't that interesting? In the land of the free. Well, they should have baked him a cake, but charged him five times the price. From the Department of, he's still around, Nation of Islam head Louis Farrakhan says the U.S. developed Ebola to kill black people. Shh. Louis, you talk too much. I told you, keep your mouth shut. From the Department of Not Everyone Loves Francis, the Vatican says that it's planning to take all papal blessings and the parchment they've written on in the house of January 1st that has Roman calipers and vendors absolutely livid. I don't even understand that shit. From the Department of Wheels on the Bus Go Flat, a pro-Israel group has filed a suit against New York's Metro Transit Authority for rejecting an ad containing the words Hamas killing Jews. I still don't understand why people feel compelled to play out their politics on the side of a bus. From the Department of My Name is Bob, I'm here to get gay married. A Baptist church in Louisiana told a local AA chapter to find a new home because they're afraid that if they have to host AA, they'll also have to host gay weddings. Or something like that. From the Department of Not the kind of guys you want to sit next to, did you hear about the... I told you that story before. Yeah. Well, anyhow, that's not too exciting. No, it isn't. From the Department of Suffer the Children, it's National Down Syndrome Awareness Month. And Amy Julia Becker writes about the struggle to find friends for her Down Syndrome daughter. Well, we've got a lot of them around here. I mean, it's not an avalanche, but we got quite a number of them. I see them all over the place, and these, of course, Down Syndrome kids should be terminated at birth, or when, preferably before birth, when they see that there's a problem with the fetus, because these people, due to societal pressure in a Christian religion, become slaves to these Mongols. I have a book in my library called The Mongols Among Us about Mongoloids. Quite interesting. I asked some of the guys who are wrapped up with the Russian version of what's going on over there in the eastern Ukraine about these Chinese brigades being used by these people. And I got this answer. Dear Tom, Chinese nationals are now serving as volunteers in Novorossiya's International Brigade. This kind of racial cooperation and fighting common enemy will pay huge dividends. You see, this is not a real racist, because if he's going to team up with the Chinese, and actually Chinese communists, to kill other white people in the Ukraine, what's going on there? I can't buy into that stuff. Not at all. Being manipulated, all these people over there on both sides, when it's about that big gas pipeline they're wanting to put through, and they're trying to use politics to keep people going at each other. And it's not really about nationalism or racism or anything. It's about making lots of money, and lots of people are falling into the trap. Here's a comment on the Ebola situation, a note to General Kelly. With 10,000 people flying out of West Africa daily, it's only a matter of time until all corners of the world are exposed, unquote, Mobley said. Once it devours third world countries, the U.S. will be importing these cases daily. Eventually, the dusters, or the clusters, will overwhelm even the most advanced countries' ability to isolate and quarantine all those exposed. The CDC needs to be honest with us. Well, since when does any government agency be honest with us? Well, if there's enough left of the white race to rebuild, maybe it's worth it. How about that? Well, more on Ebola. At Emory University, where the first two U.S. Ebola patients were treated in August after contracting the disease in West Africa, as many as 40 bags of waste were created a day, which placed a huge burden on the hospital's waste management system. Emory's Dr. Anish Mehta, good Irish name, told colleagues at the medical meeting in September, which was first reported by Reuters. The hospital's waste management hauler, Stericycle, initially refused to handle the material created by Emory's Ebola patients, making the hospital wait for 6 days with piling up waste before the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention stepped in and brokered an emergency deal with the waste hauler. Patients stricken with Ebola commonly suffer from heavy vomiting, diarrhea, and sometimes bleeding through the eyes and ears, which creates a large amount of infected material, and a high need for quick and proper disposal of the soiled linens and medical paraphernalia. Ebola spreads through the human secretions such as vomit, blood, and urine. Cool, baby. Cool. National Waste and White Recycling Association and its members are working with the CDC and the U.S. Department of Transportation to resolve issues affecting the management of medical waste material from Ebola patients, unquote. Here's where I get into the act, said Tom Metzger, spokesman for the Washington-based association. You know, there are a lot of Tom Metzgers around lately. Quote, we are confident that healthcare waste industry that we represent is capable of safely managing this material in a manner that's protective of public health and safety. However, we are bound to operate within the law, and current federal regulations effectively restrict transportation of this material, Mr. Metzger said. Quote, we are awaiting approval and comprehensive guidance from federal agencies. Ha, 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 ha. Oh, man. Now, if Ebola evolves into something that is infectious when you breathe, we're all screwed. Oh, man. Well, it could clear out the entire continent of Africa like General Montgomery wanted to do after World War II, and his government hid those comments in the archives. They were dug out a few years ago, that he wanted to turn Africa into one big international park. and get rid of all the niggers. He wasn't too good of a general, but he sounds like a pretty good racist. The DOT classifies Ebola as a Category A agent, one that is potentially life-threatening and requires special packaging and discard. The CDC, however, allows for the containment of Ebola-infected materials to be stored in leak-proof containers, categorized as regulated medical waste that can be hauled by non-specialized waste management companies. This reminds me of the getting rid of nuclear waste and how sloppy that is. Now, you can imagine all these waste material companies are hiring the cheapest labor they can get, you know, Mexican illegals, everything else, and then all the dumb Negroes that they've got working for them who are going to make mistakes. They're going to break these bags with the contamination in and all kinds of stuff. In Emory's case, the hospital sent its staff to raid their local Home Depot for 32-gallon rubber waste containers with lids so they could store the Ebola waste while a transportation deal was being brokered, Reuters reported. Boy, I'll tell you, the United States is ready for any kind of emergency, aren't they? Jesus. But we got plenty to buy bombs and bomb the shit out of everybody. While U.S. hospitals may be clinically prepared to deal with Ebola, maybe, it says here, this regulatory glitch may catch many hospitals off guard and unprepared when having to deal with their own patients, lessening their ability to treat the disease, said Dr. Gavin McGregor Skinner, an expert on public health preparedness at Pennsylvania State University. Well, remember a few months ago when they said Homeland Security was ordering millions of rounds of ammunition, or hundreds of thousands of rounds or whatever, and they're beefing up this Homeland Security? Well, it may be that once this Ebola starts breaking out in different parts and different cities, people are going to go spastic. And maybe that's what that's all about. Not to face a threat by the people uprising over political reasons, but health reasons, that when people start dropping dead all around you. Yeah, that may be the reason they want all that ammo. Treating Ebola patients represents an occupational health and safety risk. No shit. Ebola patients create an enormous amount of waste that is deemed Category A, highly infectious, able to kill people with no vaccine. And now you want a private company to say, yeah, we'll take the waste, no problem. That's not going to happen. We don't have the logistics organized. Hospitals and waste management companies also have to be concerned that Ebola waste isn't used for nefarious reasons. Yeah, there you go. They grab a few bags of these and spread them around the downtown in the cities like New York City, Chicago, and so forth. That would be like biological warfare. And a lot of blacks and stuff that work in these kind of companies are radicals and have biosecurity procedures in place to guarantee the waste stays in the hospital. The waste management system is tightly controlled, he said. So far, no such systems are in place in many U.S. hospitals. Quote, we have a long way to go. We are nowhere near ready yet, Dr. McGregor Skinner said. Well, you better hurry. You better hurry, buddy. Part of the solution brokered with Emory and Stericycle by the CDC was to bring in one of the university's jumbo sterilizers, dubbed an autoclave. An autoclave uses pressurized steam to help sanitize Ebola's infectious agents. The sanitized waste was then handed to Stericycle for its incineration. Many hospitals don't have autoclaves or incinerators on site, or if they do, they haven't been used in so long that many times they don't know whether they're operational or not. Waste management may prove to be an obstacle at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas, which is now treating the first Ebola patient to be diagnosed on U.S. soil. calls to the hospital on how they're managing their waste weren't immediately returned. No, don't take that call. Don't take that call. It is unknown whether the hospital is either an incinerator or an autoclave to deal with the patient's waste. And all the nurses just ran out of the hospital. Meanwhile, the number of people whom infected patient in Dallas came in contact with while he was contagious has grown, leaping to as many as 100, according to the Texas health officials. Well, you know as well as I do, the nigger's going to lie. There's a lot more people he's came in contact with. Four or five of the infected patient's family members are under a controlled order to stay inside their homes. Well, I heard a guy on TV saying there's nothing to worry about if you're not contagious or if you don't have it. So if that's true, why are they keeping the people inside their homes? The West African countries of Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea have experienced the worst outbreak of Ebola in history, killing more than 3,000 people and affecting others. A total of 6,574 cases have been reported. There have been many scares within the U.S. leading to the confirmation of the first U.S. case of Ebola. On Tuesday, Ebola tests have been given in Miami, New York, New Mexico, and California. All these cases were negative. Well, just something else to keep you up at night. Sorry, I'm laughing, but Mother Nature, I'm with Mother Nature. Whatever Mother Nature decides, that's what I'll respect. She wants to get rid of us all. Well, she's going to do it. If she only wants to get rid of half of us, she'll do it. Well, a recent study says the best concealed carry handgun is the Ruger LCR. It's compact 38 special caliber revolver built by Ruger. The LCR acronym stands for the Lightweight Compact Revolver. It incorporates several novel features such as a polymer grip and a trigger housing, monolithic receiver, and constant force trigger. At 13.5 ounces, the LCR is nearly 50% lighter than the stainless steel SP-101, and with only the barrel of a fluted cylinder made of stainless steel, the frame is aluminum alloy, and the synthetic glass filled polymer finished in matte black and synergistic hard coat. The LCR operates in double action only as the hammer is concealed within the frame handle's fire control housing of the gun and cannot be cocked prior to firing. In order to create a crisp, light trigger pull that is non-stacking, it features a friction-reduced cam, a feature seldom found on double-action revolvers, which by nature of their mechanism normally have a very heavy trigger pull. Well, I don't know about you, but I don't feel safe with a .38. There's the graveyards full of dead cops trying to stand off drug-crazed niggers with .38s. That's why the .45 was developed after they went down to the Philippines and they were firing these 38s at these hucks that were high on drugs with cords wrapped around their testicles pulled tight, and they charged like crazy people, and 38s would not stop them. And many cops have been killed, like in Chicago and New York, when these guys get on PCP, and you can shoot them right through the heart, and they're still going to keep coming. They can get you. They can kill you even after they're dead on their feet. So you can have your lightweight 38s. I'll stick with my heavyweight 45, or better yet, my sawed-off double gauge double barrel shotgun. And come at me with that. Come at me like that, and I've got a dum dum for you. In the meantime, pepper spray has served me fine. I don't get too excited. Well, that's about it for today. We'll be back tomorrow on Freya's Day, Ladies Day in the Bunker. In the meantime, 14 words, and keep your pie holes shut. don't forget, worse is better for now.
People are queer, they're always crowing, scrambling and rushing about. Why don't they stop someday? Talk to themselves this way. Why are we here? Where are we going? It's time that we found out. We're not here to stay. We're on a short holiday. It's just a bowl of cherries. Don't make it serious. It's too mysterious. You work. You say you worry so, but you can't take your dough when you go, go, go. So keep repeating, it's the berries, the strongest oak must fall. The sweeping delight to you were just loan. How can you lose what you've never known? Life.